From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. All right, what are the birds, Mr. Tambourine Man, the Mamas and the Papas, California Dreaming, the Beach Boys' Good Vibrations, the Monkees' Last Train to Clarksville, Simon and Garfunkel's Bridge Over Troubled Water, and Nancy Sinatra's These Boots Are Made for Walking have in common? Well, those hit records, as well as Wichita Lineman, MacArthur Park, River Deep, Mountain High, and literally hundreds of other hit records, were all played by the same group of studio musicians, regardless of who did the singing. That group of musicians is the subject of a great new book called The Wrecking Crew, the inside story of rock and roll's best-kept secret. The author is Kent Hartman, and he is with us this week. Kent Hartman, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Well, thank you very much.
It's a wonderful book. It's a must-read, I think, for music fans. Now, you know, there was this huge backlash against the Monkees when it was learned that they didn't play their own instruments. But it turns out that Gary Puckett, the Grassroots, the Tijuana Brass, no one played their own instruments.
Well, out of L.A., I would say that's true. Most of the people didn't for quite a while. The Wrecking Crew secretly played those instruments because the record labels and the producers wanted it that way. And they didn't want us, the listeners, to know.
Why didn't they want us to know?
Well, they thought it would be bad for business because, you know, the Beach Boys, you know, people are always startled when I tell them that other than the first two or three Beach Boys hits, the Wrecking Crew played all the instruments on all their hits. So, you know, the entire Pet Sounds album, for example, was just all the Wrecking Crew. And anyway, the record labels like Capitol for the Beach Boys thought that music buyers wouldn't take too kindly to the knowledge that their favorite bands weren't playing their own instruments. So they didn't want to take that risk, so they just didn't put any credits on the albums.
It's weird because nobody, I mean, everybody who buys a Frank Sinatra record knows that Frank is not playing the music, he's just singing.
Right.
So I don't know why it was such a big deal. But the Wrecking Crew, they didn't just play on the songs. I mean, some of the songs that the Wrecking Crew turned into hits are just awful. they're not great songs. The one in your book that I'm thinking of is I Got You Babe.
Oh, uh-huh. That's not a favorite of yours?
Well, I mean, I love the record, but it's not a particularly great song. The Wrecking Crew made it a great record. Would you agree?
Yes, it was as simple as it may sound now to listen to I Got You, Babe. It was even simpler when Sonny Bono crafted it, if you can call it that. That's a loosely used word there. but anyway, he wrote the song. But it's just, if you listen to it, it's all in one chord. So there's no movement. There's really nothing happening. And so, as I write in the book, Carol Kay, the only woman in the Wrecking Crew, which was a rare thing back then, she came up with the famous lick, you know, the bum, 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 ba, bum, bum, ba, bum. Mm-hmm. You know, it's got that little hop to it. Sonny had no hop. There was no groove there. So Carol supplied that, and it actually turned a dud into a gem.
And that's, of course, not the only one. I mean, some of the songs that they played on are wonderful songs, but the things that the Wrecking Crew brought to the songs made them more radio-friendly, made them, I mean, if you the other day, when I was finished reading your book, I got all the records out that I had, and I listened to them all at once. I went from, you know, listening for about 3 hours to Wrecking Crew songs.
Was that vinyl or CD?
CD, I have to confess.
Okay.
But do you think it makes a difference?
Some people would argue it. You know, the people in the Wrecking Crew, a lot of them are very partial to vinyl because they, you know, that's what they're used to. But they say it brings out it brings out the sound that they intended to create, because when they were recording those songs, they were played back on tape and then put onto vinyl, and that's the sound of the vinyl is what they had in mind when they were recording, if you know what I mean.
I do, but on the other hand, when you think about how you heard those songs, or at least how I heard them and people my age, you know, when we heard Mr. Tambourine Man and California Dreamin' and These Boots Are Made for Walking, we heard them on the AM radio.
Yes. And that's a good point, too, because the producers like Bones Howe and even Brian Wilson with the Beach Boys, they would actually have a little tinny mono speaker in the control booth. So after they recorded these songs and they sounded great coming back on the giant monitors in there, then they would also play it back through the little tinny speaker. And if it didn't sound good there, then they did a different mix because they wanted it to sound good in your car on your little AM radio.
Yeah, so that's my question. They had a certain they knew what would sound good on AM radio, the Wrecking Crew.
Yes, they knew that too, for sure. And that's also why Phil Spector, you know, he's known for being so partial to recording in mono. And, every single that he put out with the Wrecking Crew playing the instruments, Righteous Brothers and the Crystals and the Ronettes and all of that, those were all recorded in mono and released in mono because that's the way Phil liked it, and it's also the way people would hear it back then. Few people had stereos in 1962.
Yeah, no, everybody had those little transistor radios.
yeah.
On the beach and car radios in their car. Yeah, no, I mean, of course, I love most of these. I mean, I don't love them all. There are some that just drive me crazy and I never want to hear again. But most of the songs that you talk about in your book are great, great records, like Wichita Lineman. What a great record that is.
Yeah, and that's Glenn Campbell's favorite of anything he ever did. And, of course, who does he hire to play on it but his pals from the Wrecking Crew? So for those who don't know, Glenn Campbell got his start in Hollywood as part of the Wrecking Crew and was an anonymous guitar player until he finally made it big, and then he hired all of his own friends to play his hits.
Well, what are some songs you can think of, Ken Hartman, that, you listen for the guitar, that's Glenn Campbell?
One that comes to mind for sure is Dance, Dance, Dance by the Beach Boys.
Uh-huh.
So when you hear that start, you know, it's got, and that immediate guitar goes,
right, electric guitar.
Yeah, that's Glenn. So that's an example of what he did. And he also played and just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in by the first edition. So that's pretty psychedelic.
Yeah. So he was very versatile. He wasn't just a country guy.
No, he was country, but he could play anything, as could the rest of the Wrecking Crew, and that's part of why they were hired all the time. You know, if you're going to replace all these real bands in the studio on the instruments, then you better sound like what the producer wants those bands to sound like. So the Wrecking Crew could come in and play light pop, they could play heavy rock, they could play psychedelic, they could play surf music, they could play whatever was needed. They were... in my mind, did you ever see the movie by Woody Allen called Zelig?
Sure.
Yeah, and he played Leonard Zelig, the human chameleon. And that's what the Wrecking Crew reminds me of. They remind me of a bunch of Zeligs.
They can be anywhere. They can be the Mamas and the Papas or the Beach Boys or a Frank Sinatra band.
Yes.
So let's talk about more of the personnel. You mentioned Carole Kaye and Glenn Campbell.
Yep.
Hal Blaine, who I guess is the most prolific of all of them.
Yeah, some people know Hal Blaine's name, some people don't, but he was, you know, there were three or four drummers in the Wrecking Crew. And again, the Wrecking Crew, it was a loose configuration of a couple of dozen people, so you wouldn't always have the same drummer on every song. But Hal Blaine was what I would call the drummer-in-chief of the whole group, and he also named them the Wrecking Crew, which became their nickname among producers. And so, but Hal played on 40 number one hits during the 60s, which, as a drummer, which has got to be a record.
Yeah, wow. And what was the first one? What was the last one? Ed, do you have any idea? Do you remember?
Well, the first number one that he played on, I would have to look this up. That's a good question. I don't know the first number one that he played on. I can tell you, I think the last number one that he played on was... if it went to number one, and I think it did, the theme from Mahogany by Diana Ross.
Oh, uh-huh, yeah.
In about 75 or 6, whenever that was.
Yeah, that's not a bad record. I like that
one. I think that was his last one, though his last really big one.
It's grammatically incorrect, that theme from Mahogany, but I don't mind that.
But his second to last number one, I believe, was Love Will Keep Us Together in 75, which was the Grammy Song of the Year, and that was Hal Blaine's 7th Grammy-winning Song of the Year.
Now, isn't that odd that that's a song that was Song of the Year? Because really, I don't want to hear that song again. Do you? Are you a fan of that one?
I'll tell you this about it. It came out when I was 15, and it was played everywhere all the time, and it was huge.
Yes.
And I did not run out and buy a Captain and Tennille album.
No.
However, today, I can listen to the song and appreciate it for different reasons. The two main reasons are Hal is the drummer, because he's in the Wrecking Crew, and that's my thing. But also, if you just listen to the production of it, if you're thinking, okay, what was in Daryl Dragon's mind, you know, the captain of the Captain and Tennille,
mm-hmm.
how was he trying to craft this song? Well, if you wanted to have a number one hit in 1975 and just have it be a smash and a half, he just perfectly executed that song. It was everything you could want in a frothy pop song.
Okay, I'll give you that. Hey, we're talking to Kent Hartman, and his new book is called The Wrecking Crew, The Inside Story of Rock and Roll's Best Kept Secret, and the subtitle continues, The Unknown Studio Musicians Who Recorded the Soundtrack of a Generation. Is that the longest subtitle in book history?
It's up there.
But it's a great book, everybody. It's really a wonderful book. I want to talk about some more of the great hits that the Wrecking Crew played on that are that have their, I guess, their trademark, their sound, like Be My Baby.
Yeah, for some that follow the Wrecking Crew or know that whole era, they think that is not only the quintessential Phil Spector song, but the quintessential Wrecking Crew song, because that's Hal Blaine playing that famous drum lick, you know, bum, 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 ba, bum, 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 ba. You know, and Hal came up with that, and it's very simple, but it made the song. And so that was Hal's contribution. Like you were mentioning earlier, how the Wrecking Crew people would contribute in ways that made the songs better, and that's what they were. They were mini arrangers, M-I-N-I, mini arrangers, and they would come in and add things to their parts that the producers hadn't thought of. Phil Spector did not come up with that drum part, as simple as it is, but Hal Blaine did, and it fit the song perfectly. And all you have to do is hear that intro now, and you know immediately what song is coming.
What would be an example of a song that you could say, you want to hear Carole Kaye on bass, listen to this track?
Well, you can pick any of a number of Beach Boys songs, for sure. You might argue that her most famous, or up there anyway, would be California Girls. It has a pretty simple bass line underneath it, but it moves, and it's interesting, and it got a bit of a, you know, she might even, if she was talking to you, might tell you it had a bit of a, you know, a jazz walking line to it.
Mm.
And anyway, she loved playing for Brian Wilson. They all did. Brian was really young then. He was 22, 23, 24 when he was in his prime. And he was just this kid. The Wrecking Crew were all like 10 years older than he was. But they really respected him. And Carole respected him a lot. And she didn't reserve that respect for a lot of different of these producers. You know, she was pretty picky because she was a very skilled player. And she and the Wrecking Crew admired Brian Wilson a lot.
Well, now, Brian Wilson, I guess, is different than some of the other producers because he's also the artist on the record, right?
Yeah. And, of course, you know, he doesn't let his own brothers and his cousin and whoever else was in the Beach Boys play on these songs. But, you know, he had a sit-down talk with him, like in 63, I believe it was, and just told him, hey, I want to expand things. I don't want to go out on the road. You guys go play on the road. I'll make the records here. When you come home, you can slap your vocals on there. And at first, they were a little offended, I think. But over time, you know, I think they got used to it. Because, you know, hey, they're out on the road making the good money, getting all the girls, having a great time. And then Brian cooks up these hits back home.
Now, but Brian Wilson was a more than adequate bass player himself. He would prefer to have Carole Kaye do the bass part than himself?
Yeah, I think, you know, if you were talking to Brian, he would probably say, hey, Carole was actually a better bass player than I was. Brian was a good bass player and a good piano player and a great producer and a great songwriter. But, you know, he didn't want to have to wear every hat in the studio. He wanted to be in the booth behind the glass, essentially directing the activities of the Wrecking Crew out in the studio.
I was sort of surprised to read that Simon and Garfunkel also used the Wrecking Crew, because we think of Simon and Garfunkel as, well, we know that Paul Simon is a consummate guitar player, one of the greats.
Yeah.
And I'm sure he does all the guitar parts on his records. Yes, no? The Wrecking Crew play guitar on The Boxer or whatever?
No. Paul, well, here's the thing. Paul played most of the guitar parts on their records. With, you know, I'm just talking about when he used the Wrecking Crew, starting with Bookends in 68.
Mm-hmm.
Paul is a great guitar player. But He would tell you that he is exceptional at rhythm playing, but in terms of lead playing, he doesn't feel that's his strength. He's not good at improvising. He's very good at structuring things and then playing it as he's mapped it out. So when you listen to the Bridge Over Troubled Water album, they brought in a Nashville guitarist to play a lot of the lead lines on there and different things. So Paul and this other guitarist are playing on there. And then it's three guys from the Wrecking Crew from L.A. It's Hal Blaine on drums, Larry Nechtel on piano, and then Joe Osborne on bass.
Now, Larry Nechtel also was a bass player, wasn't he?
He was. Larry, if you were to ask me, who do you think was the most talented musician in the Wrecking Crew, I would say Larry Nechtel. He was...
A member of Bread, wasn't he?
He was. Yeah. Once the Wrecking Crew started to sort of wind down and their services weren't in as big a demand by the early 70s, Larry hooked on with David Gates and became a member of Bread. But prior to that, you know, Larry Nechtel played, you know, that barrel house piano on Rockin' Pneumonia, and he played the bass on Light My Fire. He played the Hammond organ on Good Vibrations. He played the grand piano on Bridge Over Troubled Water. I mean, Larry could play anything and play it just pretty much better than anybody.
And he created the part that he played on Bridge Over Troubled Water, you said in your book.
He did. He did. Larry was a good friend of mine, and I talked to him about this a lot. Anyway, he told me that, you know, he was in the studio. The reason Simon and Garfunkel, by the way, used the Wrecking Crew, or specifically three members of the Wrecking Crew, Hal, Joe, and Larry, is that, you know, Simon and Garfunkel were East Coast New York City guys, but, you know, they were having hits in the mid-60s, but they were hearing all these things coming out of L.A., and they learned through the grapevine that, you know, these people, you know, what we call today the Wrecking Crew, were playing these instruments on these things. And they wanted in on that. They wanted to see what that would sound like for them. And they fell in love with Hal, Joe, and Larry. So Bookends and Bridge Over Troubled Water, those two albums, which are, you know, their two biggest albums in terms of sales, they used them. And, yes, Larry Nechtel was brought in. Paul Simon loved him. He worked with Larry for quite a while to hammer out that intro piano part. And then in terms of the way the song flowed with the piano and the vocal, Larry Nechtel worked for like 3 days with Art Garfunkel, something like 72 takes, to get it to the point where we know it today.
Talk also a little bit about, I guess it's maybe it's the Boxer that has a very strange kind of percussion. In fact, it's not unlike the percussion that's on the Righteous Brothers Phil Spector recordings. Is that right? Is it the Boxer that has this weird percussion that they recorded in an elevator shaft or something?
Well, yes. The Boxer was the first song recorded for the Bridge Over Troubled Water album. It was recorded in, I think, April of 69, so several months before they did the bulk of the album. And what Simon and Garfunkel would do at that point with their producer slash engineer Roy Halley, who was their right-hand man and very, very valuable to them. It was really a threesome that put those albums together. Anyway, they would record in L.A. and use the Wrecking Crew, but occasionally they would go back to New York to CBS Records there and have Hal, Joe, or Larry, or all three come back there and cut some things. So the Wrecking Crew members did occasionally go to New York when they were needed. In terms of the Boxer, Paul Simon had written the song, and when there's that lie-la-lie in the chorus, he wanted to have a crashing sound. Now, back then, studios didn't have very many effects like they do today. Things were pretty rudimentary. So he had Hal Blaine fly to New York, and they actually put a snare drum with Hal at the bottom of an elevator shaft to get that giant booming echo. And so he would just go wham on the snare, and that's what you hear today.
We're talking with Kent Hartman, and his book is called The Wrecking Crew, The Inside Story of Rock and Roll's Best Kept Secret. Talk a little bit about Jim Gordon.
Yeah, Jim Gordon was, many would say, within and without, outside of the Wrecking Crew, that perhaps he was the most talented drummer of them all. That guy was a natural. He had a built-in groove machine like nobody's business. So he played on, early on, he became a protege of Hal Blaine's in the late 60s. He was a young guy in L.A. He had just the most fantastic chops. Hal would give him his overflow work. What dates Hal couldn't do, he would give him to Jim Gordon because he knew Jim was earnest and he was a great player and he would be professional. And so when you hear Woman, Woman by Gary Puckett and Union Gap, that's Jim Gordon playing drums. When you hear Wichita Lineman, which you mentioned earlier, that's Jim Gordon playing drums on that. He played with Harry Nilsson, I believe, on Everybody's Talking and a lot of stuff. Anyway,
yeah.
Jim Gordon, of course, as you probably know, he had undiagnosed schizophrenia, and unfortunately he heard voices, and his mental state went downhill, and he took drugs which he shouldn't have taken, and he hooked up with Derek and the Dominoes, which made it worse. And then he ended up eventually killing his mother, which is sad to say.
So is he still alive?
He's alive, and he's still in the California prison system in a mental hospital unit, and I believe he's still, you know, taking the necessary drugs to keep his mental problems in check, and I don't see him getting out of jail.
That's one of the most bizarre stories of a wrecking crew. But what about the rest of them? What happened to them all? Where are they now?
Well, oh, and by the way, Jim Gordon co-wrote Layla with Eric Clapton.
Right.
When you hear that piano coda, the second half of it, that's Jim Gordon that not only wrote it, but he's actually playing it. He actually could play the piano a little bit, and Clapton let him do that. So
That's not a little bit. That's a beautiful little symphony.
It is. It's something he'd been fooling around with for quite a while, and he didn't know what to do with it. He was thinking of putting it on maybe a solo album, and Jim Gordon's girlfriend at that time was Rita Coolidge, and they used to fool around on the piano and kind of come up with little parts like that, and they would laugh and laugh, you know, because they couldn't decide who was the worst piano player. And but anyway, that was a pretty nice little hook he came up with, and there you go.
It's beautiful. Yeah, what a beautiful.
So
rhythm.
You asked, where are they now?
Yes, tell us, where's Carole Kaye? Where's Hal Blaine? What are they doing now?
Hal Blaine is mostly retired, but he does give drum clinics occasionally. He lives in Palm Desert, and we're pretty good friends, and I talk to him occasionally. And he's 83 years old now.
Wow.
He's like the elder statesman of the wrecking crew. Carole Kaye is living up toward Valencia in that area by Magic Mountain north of L.A., and she's somewhat retired, though I think she still does play the occasional gig if it's offered, and, you know, I think she does a bit of teaching and things like that. And Larry Nechtel, unfortunately, died a couple of years ago. And Glenn Campbell, as we know, he is retiring this summer because he's got Alzheimer's.
Yeah, he's, what, 75 now, I think?
Yeah, he is. Really a nice guy, and he gave me fantastic interviews for the book. And I got these a number of years ago before his problems started to pop up.
Well, that's great.
So, but a lot of others, you know, sadly, I'd say probably half the wrecking crew are dead. You know, Tommy Tedesco has died, and Al Casey has died, and seems like a lot of the guitarists died. I don't know why that is.
How did the door close on the wrecking crew? What happened that they were no longer in demand?
By the early 1970s, music was changing. That was one of the biggest reasons. Bands were coming along that insisted on playing their own instruments. So you had people like the Eagles and the Doobie Brothers and Chicago and all sorts of bands like that that were very good on their instruments and also insisted on playing them themselves. Also, I think as we went into the new decade, society had changed some, you know, music listeners. We expected perhaps more authenticity, I would say, among our musicians because, you know, you think about the movie The Graduate, which was Simon and Garfunkel playing the songs, which the wrecking crew were playing for them. But you remember that scene in there about the guy says, "Ben, I want to tell you one thing," and he says, "Plastics."
Yeah.
And that really stuck, and that sort of embodied what a lot of younger people found to be a problem with where we were in the 60s, especially the late 60s. So I think that had a little bit of an effect, too. You know, by the early 70s, we didn't want, quote-unquote, plastic. We wanted real. And so we wanted our bands to play all their own instruments.
Well, before we end this conversation, I want to talk a little bit about the Sinatra session that the Wrecking Crew did. I imagine they did more than one, but the one you write about in your book.
Yes, they did a bunch. They did Something Stupid, which Frank did with his daughter Nancy, and then, of course, they did all of her hits, including These Boots Are Made for Walkin'. Also, they did That's Life for Frank Sinatra.
Oh, I love that one. Who plays the organ on that?
That was a guy named Mike Melvoin, who also just passed away, and he was in the Wrecking Crew. Really a great organ, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Very soulful.
Yeah, Mike told me all about that. So, but the song you're referring to that I talk about in great detail in the book is Strangers in the Night. And so it was recorded at United Recorders in Hollywood in United A, which was the big room there. And, the producer Jimmy Bowen picked several members of the Wrecking Crew to be the rhythm section that day, and then he brought in some strings and horns and that kind of thing. And anyway, it was just a fantastic session. And as I write about in the book, it only lasted three takes because really Frank Sinatra was a one or two take guy. And yes, he could do a great version in one or two takes, but also he didn't have the patience to hang out. Frank was on the move, you know, he had parties to go to, he had things to do, you know. And so, but the Wrecking Crew was there, and I write about Michele Rubini, who was a male. Everybody called him Mike Rubini, but he was in the Wrecking Crew, and he played piano on Strangers of the Night, and he was sitting there next to Sinatra while he was singing. And, you know, and Michele told me all about this, where, you know, Sinatra, the song Strangers of the Night actually doesn't have any lyrics to cover the last, you know, 30 or 40 seconds of it. And so the music kept going, but Frank didn't know what to do because Frank wasn't used to that. He was used to singing, close to the end of the song and not having some big fade. And he felt uncomfortable. And so he sang it the first way through, and then he stopped and said, well, what the hell am I supposed to do here when the music keeps playing? And so the producer said, well, why don't you just scat your way out? You know, he says, you're the king of that. So Frank gives it another try, and he kind of just does some tra-la-las. And you know, everybody, they didn't want to say it to him, but they thought it sounded kind of lame. And so the producer, you know, taking his life in his hands, he over the talkback mic from the booth, he said, Frank, why don't we give it one more try? He says, you know, just do something a little different this time. And, you know, Frank was getting steamed by then. You know, he's standing there with a cigarette in his hand, and he's glaring at the booth, and he's in front of all these people. And you did not shame Frank Sinatra in front of other people. And so anyway, Frank, you know, he was as cool as they came, and he was a pro. And so they ran take three, and it got to that last part, and so he just cut loose with what we all know today as those doobie-doobie-doos, you know, all that stuff. And the producer knew enough at the end of that to say, okay, that's a wrap. We're done. Thanks, Frank. And so Frank and his entourage cut out of there. And, of course, the producer, though, had to think that over in the booth. He thought, well, I either have the coolest thing ever here or people are going to laugh at this because it was really different. And so he went with his gut. He sent it to Top 40 Radio, and they loved it. The song went right to number one, and it knocked the Beatles' Paperback Writer off the top of the charts.
It's a great story. And there's also great stories about The Eve of Destruction and Limbo Rock and so many other great crazy songs in this wonderful book called The Wrecking Crew, The Inside Story of Rock and Roll's Best Kept Secret, Traveling Man. That's a good story, too. You can read them all, and you should. The author is my guest, Kent Hartman. Thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Yes, thank you. And I'd like to add one thing that my publisher just mentioned, that the book is in its fifth printing, and it's been selling out in a lot of physical bookstores. So the quickest way to get it, I'm told, is to go to Amazon.
And you can download it in seconds on your Kindle.
Yes.
Thank you again, Ken Hartman.
Yes, thank you.
Well, that's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. Has a half hour ever gone by so quickly? I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did and that you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org, subscribe to the podcast at iTunes, or visit us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Kent Hartman. His book is called The Wrecking Crew, The Inside Story of Rock and Roll's Best Kept Secret. Production assistance on From the Bookshelf is provided by Francis Venegas. Thanks, Francis. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.